From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, we hear from some of our favorite writers about the past decade in culture. First up, highlights and trends in the film world with Travell Anderson and New York Times film critic Manola Dargis.
I think this has been an amazing decade for documentaries. We talk about them with other movies in a way, you know, that they're part of just how we talk about movies, not like, oh, these are these great movies, and oh, here are some documentaries sitting in the corner sadly.
And then we'll hear how pop music evolved over the past decade. All that coming up on The Frame. On this first Friday of the new year, we're looking back at the past decade in culture, and we'll start with movies, you know, those things you used to see in theaters. Joining me are Manola Dargis, the co-chief film critic at the New York Times, and culture writer Travell Anderson. Travell and Manola, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Very glad to be here.
So, in preparation for this conversation, we each made a list of the 10 films we thought really moved the needle culturally in the last decade. Not necessarily the best, maybe they are, but I'm curious to see what you guys brought in. I'm going to flip a coin. Heads, Manola, you're up first.
Thanks, John, for that. What I did is brought in my list that I made with my colleague A.O. Scott at the New York Times, and Tony and I did a list of our favorites, but we also did a list of what we felt were the most influential. Right off the bat, the perfect example would be the 2012 movie The Avengers.
So, this all seems horrible.
I've seen worse.
Sorry.
No, we could use a little worse.
Stark, we got him.
Banner?
Just like you said.
And tell him to suit up.
With this movie, suddenly, we all had to take superhero movies differently. We had to kind of approach them differently. Mm-hmm. But it just felt like the weight of this movie seemed to augur something that was different. And what we saw over the decade is that Disney became a kind of unstoppable force. And we all live in Disney's world now.
We do. What else is on your list?
Well, influence, another would be, I think, The Hunger Games, which that may sound counterintuitive, but it was The Catching Fire, which came out in 2013. And that was actually an important movie in terms of gender representation for women. It became the first female-led movie to top the domestic box office in decades.
I volunteer as tribute.
I believe we have a volunteer.
Mr. Mayor.
She was a kind of female superhero in a way, because you can think of Katniss Everdeen in that respect. But that was actually something important. I think this decade has been very interesting in terms of women and, you know, the American movie industry, obviously.
So, Travell, are there any superhero movies on your most influential or important movies of the last decade?
There is one, and that would be Black Panther.
Okay.
I feel like, you know, sort of the conversation that you mentioned about the Avengers, Black Panther was like this amazing moment. It was the first kind of superhero movement that was fronted by a predominantly black cast. And it ended up being like a cultural moment. You had people dressing in daishikis and like, you know, cultural garb to go to the movie theater.
Your father and I will talk about this day all the time. He is with us, and it is your time to be king.
But it was really just an amazing moment to see Ryan Coogler, this independent filmmaker, get a chance to have a swing at, you know, the major studio system. And you saw with Black Panther how he kind of injected a lot of kind of sociocultural commentary into the story.
And it's important to note, too, that Wakanda, a fictional country, ended up on United States free trade list.
So somehow.
It's become Fredonia. It's become a real thing,
it's
which is terrifying.
Hilarious.
What's next for you?
Next for me, the oldest film on my list is from 2011 in the independent space, and that's Pariah from Dee Reese. I think it's just a great example of a queer filmmaker whose debut really like set her on this path. And I think it also was demonstrative for a lot of other queer filmmakers coming up behind her for, you know, the ability to do some of this kind of authentic storytelling in an unapologetic way. And I think it really showed a generation of queer filmmakers that we see now coming up that you can do this and you can do it authentically, do it your own way, and still be able to kind of achieve this kind of mainstream success as well.
We're talking with Manola Dargis and Travell Anderson about movies from the past decade. I'm going to put out a movie that not only won an Academy Award for Best Picture, but also meant a lot to me, and that is Barry Jenkins' Moonlight. I thought this was on our list as well.
On
everybody's list. Yeah. If it's not on your list, then you have no credibility.
Then forget it.
And maybe this is our unifying theme. This is a movie that told me a story I didn't know, and it's personal to Barry, and it's personal to a lot of people about what it means to grow up around addiction, and what it means for a young boy to struggle with sexual identity, and what it means to have people in your life who love you unconditionally. Mm-hmm. And I can hear two bars of Nicholas Britell's score from this film and start crying. It's a movie that I found beautiful and touching and hopeful. And there's so few movies that do all of those things.
But without the usual kind of like, you'd wrap a little happy bow on the package and make it everyone can feel nicely reassured and like smile. But, you know, I feel it's a very honest movie.
Yeah, too. It's a movie that I've literally watched entirely too many times and I cry every single time because it's a story that I do know and that, you know, it does reflect different parts of my own lived experience. But the way it was done, written by Terrell Alvin McCraney, Barry Jenkins, and then we can't forget the big envelope gate situation at the Oscars that year.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
Where La La Land was Best Picture for about 30 seconds?
Yes. Yeah.
This is not a joke. I'm afraid they read the wrong thing.
Moonlight, Best Picture.
And I think that even, you know, further cements it for its kind of influentialness in the decade.
It was certainly one of the great symbolic moments in recent American movie history in terms of just like the kind of like the what it signified. Like, oh, here's this very, I mean, I like La La Land and I respect it a great deal, but a kind of fantasy made by a white guy. And here's a kind of very deep, profound movie made by black people. And that just kind of comes in
very clearly. Very clearly, even in my dreams, this could not be true. But to hell with dreams. I'm done with it because this is true. Oh, my goodness.
It did what it needed to do.
Coming up on The Frame, Travell Anderson and Manola Dargis look at streaming and how it affected movie making in the past decade. Stick around. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn, and today we're discussing trends and influential films from the past decade with culture writer Travell Anderson and film critic Manola Dargis.
I think this has been an amazing decade for documentaries, and I feel there's been a kind of perception shift also with documentaries. Mm. They no longer feel like they're kind of shoved to one side as much. They feel like we talk about them with other movies in a way, you know, that they're part of just how we talk about movies, not like, oh, these are these great movies, and oh, here are some documentaries sitting in the corner sadly.
Yeah.
You know?
No, I think I agree with that. One of the films on my list, the only documentary on my list, is Ava DuVernay's 13th. I feel like there are so many of these docs that had kind of a social justice angle that really, in a lot of ways, changed conversations and changed the way that we talk about what, you know, marginalization and oppression looks like in this country. And so, like, I think you're right. We're now talking about documentaries as like great pieces of cinema as well, in a lot of ways that I feel like, you know, sometimes we don't.
I just want to say it's on my personal list as well.
The other thing I want to talk about, because there's a film on my list by a young female director, and that is Lady Bird by Greta Gerwig.
I'm friends with Jenna, and she's always talking about how great your band is, so I wanted to check it out.
Yeah, Jenna's all tight.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll see you at the Deuce or something, huh?
Sure. See you at the Deuce.
Lady Bird, to me, was a great example of a woman telling a woman's story that was a success and let her make Little Women and have a career. And I think it's important that we recognize movies that help start a career.
I think you're so right about that, and I want to throw it to one of the films that I have that I know it's probably a little left of center. And that movie is Malcolm D. Lee's Girls Trip.
Oh, and let me get a cherry coke.
Dina, can we just bring it down a notch?
Oh, can we get some this weekend?
You know what? I need you to use your lady mouth.
I need you to use your lady mouth.
It's a movie that showed that, you know, in addition to women being very funny, comedic actresses, these black women, lifting them up, I think this movie led to a lot of the attention that we now see Regina Hall getting with a lot of the work she's doing. She had Support the Girls a year later. Tiffany Haddish is literally all over the place. All over the place. And I kind of love it for what that film represented at the time and all the things it's done since.
And it's a movie that historically has been very difficult to make.
Yes.
Black women in front of the camera, a black man behind it, and yet it grossed more than $140 million worldwide. Mm-hmm. Proof that everything that Hollywood thinks is a rule can be broken.
Very much so.
Those rules are often such like pathetic rationalizations, you know, ways of rationalizing prejudice that you don't want to admit. You say, oh, no, 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 it's just all about the box office. And it's like, I'm sorry, these movies make money. So I feel like I'm just drumming my fingers at the table going, excuse me, are we out of excuses yet?
Right.
Because
we're talking with Manola Dargis and Travell Anderson about movies from the past decade. I want to ask you about streaming, and I'm going to start with a story that Nicole Holofcener told me about her film, The Land of Steady Habits. She has made all of her other movies theatrically. This was a Netflix movie, and after its first weekend on Netflix, somebody from the streaming service told her more people watched this movie over the weekend than everybody who saw all of your movies combined in theaters.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Total.
I have one quick question. Did they watch it all the way through?
Well, okay, that's a different question.
No, because Netflix people should know does not release the numbers about how many people are actually watching things. But then there's also something called the completion rate.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, and that means, did they turn Roma on and turn it off 5 minutes later?
Yeah.
You know, that's a real important.
Travell, what about this whole evolution and how it's affected the kinds of movies that are getting made and seen?
I mean, I love this question because one of the films on my list I actually don't like. But I put it there because I do think that it fits into this kind of Netflix conversation. And it's Roma, as you mentioned earlier. I think it was a film.
Wait, you didn't like Roma?
I did not like Roma. I know I'm one of like.
Ladies and gentlemen,
five people.
The one person who I know.
I know.
And God bless you.
I know, but it's.
And
it's
you liked Cats, which is weird.
Roma's just not a movie for me. But I'm not sure if we would see a movie like that if Netflix did not provide the money, the space to allow Alfonso to do whatever he wanted. And though, yes, we don't know exactly how many people are actually watching all of them or how many people would rather see them in movie theaters, but it does, it has like revolutionized, I think, you know, the way that we think about film in a lot of ways.
Let me ask you guys both this last question, and that is a filmmaker or filmmakers who you're really excited to follow their career. The guy I keep waiting for is Jonathan Glazer. He made Under the Skin in 2013 with Scarlett Johansson, a movie that still gives me nightmares. He hasn't made a movie in a while. Curious what he is up to. He's not especially young, but a guy I can't wait to see what he's got next up his sleeve.
I mean, honestly, two of the people who I'm really interested in their careers are Dee Reese and Greta Gerwig, who were mentioned before. But I think, you know, these are women who have what we are seeing. I mean, truly independent filmmakers have always had to be entrepreneurial because they need to go out and raise the money. As we all know, they have to do all this. And one of the things that's happened in the past is that women haven't always been able to do that. But women are getting the chance to be entrepreneurial.
Yeah.
And so someone like Dee Reese and someone like Greta Gerwig making the leap, having a bigger budget, having a different kind of storytelling, I think that's really interesting. And I want to see what women are going to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
Travell?
I'm going to say Peter Ramsey. He did another film, one of three directors on another film, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse.
Oh, I love that movie. Fantastic.
And, you know, fabulous animated film. The style of animation was interesting. It was an all-black cast. I'm interested in seeing what, you know, black folks in the animation space, when they get the chance to do storytelling, what they can give us.
And quickly, we're going to do a speed round. It doesn't have to be influential. It doesn't have to be best. Like 10 movies that are on your list. I'm going to start with Travell.
Decades?
What's on your list? Yeah.
Decades. So my list, my full list, it's Moonlight, Una Mujer Fantastica, Tangerine, Parasite, Black Panther, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, Girls Trip, Get Out, Roma, 13th, and Pariah, which is actually 11, not 10, because I don't follow rules.
Okay, I'm going to pick favorites, but The Assassin by Ho Chao Shen, Boyhood, Richard Linklater, Faces Places, Agnes Varda, In Jackson Heights, Frederick Weissman. All my directors are over the age of 60, I think. Luminous Intimacy, The Cinema of Nathaniel Dorsey,
Tarkovsky and Jerome Hiller, Mad Max Fury Road by George Miller, No Home Movie by Chantal Ackerman, Poetry by Lee Chang-dong, 13th by Ava DuVernay, who we've mentioned before, and A Touch of Sin by the great Chinese director Zha Zhengku.
My list, Interstellar by Christopher Nolan, Under the Skin by Jonathan Glazer, Tony Erdman by Maren Ade, Lady Bird, Greta Gerwig, Encendies by Denis Villeneuve, Moonlight, Barry Jenkins, Shape of Water, Guillermo del Toro, Fire at Sea, Gianfranco Rossi, and OJ, Made in America, Ezra Edelman.
These are all great movies. Super great lists,
yes,
you guys.
Yes, they are.
Travel and Manola, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Manola Dargis is co-chief film critic at The New York Times, and Travel Anderson is a culture writer. Up next on The Frame, a look at the past decade in pop music with the hosts of the podcast Switched on Pop. Nate Sloan and Charlie Harding host the podcast Switched on Pop. Harding is a songwriter and producer, and Sloan is a musicology teacher at USC. Toting an electric keyboard, they came to our studio to discuss the past decade in pop music and unravel some of the ideas behind its biggest hits, like this one. Hey, I just met you, and this is crazy, but here's my number, so call me maybe. It's hard to look right at your baby, but here's my number, so call me maybe. Hey, I just when you're thinking about these songs that you look at, and the further you dissect them, do you start to understand why they work the way a physicist starts to understand why an equation works out? Is a little knowledge a dangerous thing?
Well, really what's going on with a song like Call Me Maybe is the artistry of matching all of the available tones, rhythms, and so on, all of your musical knowledge with the lyric in a perfect marriage. And here we have a piece that is about nervous anticipation, and we hear that in the way that she sings her song. She waits a moment, and she pauses. She goes, pause. Nervous hesitation. Hey, I just met you. Dun.
And this is crazy.
But here's my number.
So call me maybe.
And had you just read the lyric, it probably would feel like nonsense. But when you pair it with that music, all of a sudden, all of that meaning comes out perfectly.
Yeah, it sounds very natural. You know, I think that's a common thing in really successful pop songs. It sounds like conversation turned into music. I don't know. I hear, hey, I just met you and this is crazy. That just sounds like an actual human interaction that's suddenly been turned into music. Hmm.
What does that song have to say, and is it a good entry point for the decade itself?
The reason the song is the introduction to our book is because it holds a very special place in our musical journey. It represents the conversion point when we turned from music snobs who kind of rejected the language of pop out of hand to people who really embrace and now study like full time the sound of popular music. So I think in that respect, it represents a shift that not only in our own listening, but a shift that's taken place over the past decade where pop music is something that is taken seriously now. Mainstream outlets, music critics, listeners on Twitter and other music podcasts like the one we host talk and analyze and break down with a lot of integrity the music of pop, which I think for a long time was considered kind of frivolous and not worth looking at too closely.
I want to play another song, but before I play this song, I want to ask you about understanding popular music in sophisticated terms, because you have a sentence where Gustav Mahler is right up alongside Kendrick Lamar, and you're talking about this song, Swimming Pools.
Yeah.
Changing by the minute, and the record on repeat, took a sip, then another sip, then somebody said to me.
But what you write is that Kendrick Lamar might be the most sophisticated time jacker of all time.
Yeah. I think the chorus of Swimming Pools is a great example of how artists like Kendrick Lamar can manipulate time to create this sort of dissociative effect in the listener. I got a swimming pool full of liquor and they dive in. If you listen to the drums and the synth pads, they're moving quite slowly. If you listen to Kendrick's voice, it's moving a little faster rhythmically. And then if you focus in on the hi-hats, rattling, skittering, those are moving at an almost impossibly fast rate. So you have these kind of three temporal levels existing at once, and your ear is drawn to each one of them and jumps between them, and it creates this feeling almost like inebriation, which is really what the song is about, diving into a swimming pool full of liquor.
One of the things that happened in the past decade is the way that people listen to music changed fundamentally, and that was with the advent of streaming services.
Right.
So from the artist's perspective and the songwriting perspective, is there a chicken and egg where songwriters and musicians started composing differently given the way that people were receiving and listening to music?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. On Spotify and other streaming services, you only get paid per song, not by album. You also only get paid if someone listens to at least 30 seconds. And so we've seen a slight trend of some songs getting shorter, as well as albums getting longer, because if you're going to have one album packet full of songs that people will listen all the way through, better to get paid for 25 songs instead of only 7. And we've also seen, in order to hook people in, a lot of choruses are actually being put right up front to the beginning of the song. By the way, we don't think any of this is a bad thing. Every era has these slight changes. Songs are still great. There's so much good music being made, but it is changing the way that they're being written.
And is there an example of a modern song that you think, maybe one of the songs of the decade, that is a good example of that?
One of the masters of this new streaming economy is Drake, and you can hear this in a track of his like God's Plan, which doesn't start with a verse, but starts with a little preview of a section much later in the song. It's almost like a little, like a trailer for the song.
She say, do you love me? I tell her only partly. I only love my bed and my mom, I'm sorry. 50 dub, I even got it tatted on me. 81, they'll bring the crashers to the party.
So something else happens in this decade, and that is hip-hop becomes pop.
Right.
And that changes everything. How does that happen, and what is driving that?
It's been a change a long time in the making. I mean, we discuss Outkast and Hey Ya in our first chapter, and we found this quotation from Andre Benjamin, who said he was very nervous to release that song because the idea of a singing rapper back in 2003 was kind of petrifying for him. If we fast forward to 2018, 2019, that fear would, I think, be out the window. I think the merging of hip-hop and song has become really a core part of the sound of pop music, thanks to artists like Kanye West and Drake.
We're talking with Charlie Harding and Nate Sloan about their book, Switched on Pop, How Popular Music Works and Why It Matters. I'm going to play a song that you have a chapter about by Luis Fonsi featuring Daddy Yankee, Despacito.
Fonsi, ya me está gustando más de lo normal. Todo mi sentido va pidiendo más. Esto hay que tomarlo sin ningún apuro. Despacito, quiero respirar tu cuello despacito.
The last time I looked, it was just a couple of minutes ago, I think we're up to 75 trillion of views. I don't know what the number is. So what is behind a song like Despacito?
Yeah, there's so much to unpack in this modern masterpiece. One is the song merges old and new elements. You have this kind of classic traditional Puerto Rican cuatro guitar, but you also have these very modern programmed drums. You have the characteristic reggaeton rhythm. It marries the kind of smooth romantic vocals of Luis Fonsi with the rat-a-tat, almost rap-like delivery of Daddy Yankee. I think this is a song, no matter what you're looking for in a pop track, this will have it for you.
And it's probably not that big a leap to understand the popularity of Despacito to go see a lot of people at the Rose Bowl who don't speak a word of Korean singing along with every song that a K-pop band like BTS will perform. They don't understand the words, but it doesn't matter.
K-pop has been one of the biggest and most important phenomena, especially in the second half of this decade. And groups like BTS and Blackpink and Monsta X have amassed huge international fan bases. And many of those listeners may not speak Korean, but they voraciously learn about the lyrics and the stories behind the songs online. There are actually whole translating teams that work to make sure that this is approachable for everybody. And this music is phenomenal. It's really reinvigorated the idol style group, you know, the sort of boy band girl group sort of style of music that was popular in the 90s in the United States. It's now back with a huge global audience.
Nate, there are more than a dozen songs referenced in the chapters in your book. I want you to play just a couple of bars from something and see if Charlie can guess it.
All right. Charles, you ready?
Trick question.
What's that, Charlie?
This is Taylor Swift's Mean.
Mm.
Taylor Swift's You Belong With Me and Taylor Swift's State of Grace. This is her little vocal melodic signature, the T drop that she places in all of her music, regardless of the genre she's playing in.
Nate Sloan and Charlie Harding are the authors of the new book, Switched on Pop, How Popular Music Works and Why It Matters. And that'll do it for today. Don't forget to tune in to The Frame Weekend, Saturday afternoon at 2. And thanks to the team that produces The Frame and to Taylor McFerrin, who provides our opening theme music. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We're back here Monday at the Moen Broadcast Center.